project in 2006 after an especially heated debate with the SE Linux developers on a topic now long forgotten. He develops secure operating systems, he works as a member of the Trusted Systems Interoperability Group, and he is right here.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. I'm playing with a brand new presentation environment, and so if it doesn't behave all the time, it's not my fault. All right, I'm Casey Schaffler, as our kind theater manager has already mentioned. I started out in my professional world doing a port of Unix version 6 to a 32-bit machines. It was the first commercial 32-bit port of Unix. I was the first engineer on the development of Trusted Solaris. I was the architect for Trusted IRIX, which has been evaluated at B1, LSPP, CAP, and CAP levels. I was a member of the United States National Security Agency's TrustX group, which did a lot of the seminal work in policy development for operating systems back in the 1980s. I was the technical editor for the POSIX P1003 1E2C work, which developed the interfaces which are currently available in Linux as the capabilities and the access control lists, give or take. Also, TSIG, which is the Trusted Systems Interoperability Group, which did the protocol definitions that were thrown out in favor of IPsec, primarily because they didn't have cryptography. And certain people in certain venues just can't believe in a security policy protocol if it doesn't have cryptography involved, which is okay. You know, there are people like that. So what am I going to talk about today? I'm going to talk about mandatory access control, and I'm going to talk about what mandatory access control is good for. Then I'm going to talk about how SMAC implements mandatory access control and what SMAC is good for. And then, if we've got time, I'm going to wallow in the details of how SMAC's implemented. Okay, so mandatory access control. We've got some concepts here. The three concepts of mandatory access control that are really important: subjects, objects, and access. Okay, so a subject is an active entity, a user, a process, a task. Anything that's actually doing something is a subject. Now, an object is a passive entity, a file, a directory, a message queue. Anything that stores information is going to be an object. And an access is what happens when a subject does something to an object. So that's an access. You have access controls to prevent any subject from doing things to any object. There are old operating systems that just allowed that any subject could do anything it wanted to any object. Modern operating systems don't allow that, primarily because things tend to get shared. There are a lot of objects out there that if they get damaged or modified in inappropriate ways, things don't work very well. So there are a lot of reasons why you want to have access control. So those are the concepts. Now the principles, and by the way, the outline of my talk is based on what I wrote for the proposal. So I wrote up the proposal thinking I better say everything about what I'm going to talk about or what I could possibly talk about to get this thing accepted, because this is such a great conference. And so I wrote down a very elaborate blurb, and then I thought, gee, I'm going to have to come up with a lot of slides to talk about this. So if I talk fast and go through a lot of slides quickly, that's why, because I've got a lot to cover here. Okay, so principles. The principles of mandatory access control, this is what makes mandatory access control different from everybody else. Okay. The user has no say in the access control decision. Okay. The fact that you own that file doesn't give you the right to change the access control characteristics on it. It's tough. It's out of your control. And it's based on system-controlled attributes. So I can't change the attributes on the files. That's up to the system to decide what attributes go onto the files. And I'm saying system-controlled attributes. There are mandatory access control systems, AppArmor, Tomoko, which I'm sure I pronounced incorrectly, that use the path name as a mandatory access control attribute. So it, but that's a system attribute. You don't get a say in the access control based on what you want. It's what the system wants. Jargon. We've, of course, in mandatory access control, like everything else, we got a bunch of jargon. We reuse acronyms just like everybody else. First one, MAC, mandatory access control. I'm not talking about the chip address or anything like that. There are at least six different acronyms, MAC, in the Linux kernel. The label. A label is what we call the attribute that you're using to make the access control decision. So it could contain any of a number of things, but y'all just call it a label and then you don't really have to worry about what's in it. Okay. Bell and LaPadula. Dave Bell and Lynn LaPadula were a couple of mathematicians working at the MITRE Corporation. They were asked by the United States government to come up with a mathematical description of the US DoD security policy for paper documents. And they went away, and they came back, and they came back with two papers. One paper was why you couldn't mathematically describe 20% of the policy. The other paper was a mathematical description of the 80% that you could. Okay. That's called the Bell and LaPadula sensitivity policy. I'll say Bell and LaPadula. I might even say B&L. When I'm talking about that, what I'm talking about is a mathematical model of the paper security world. Multi-level security came out of Bell and LaPadula. Essentially, what this is saying is that when we're talking about multi-level security, you may have things that are more secret than other things, or secret in different ways from other things. But they may be hierarchical, they may be separated out by categories, but you're going to have a number of levels of security, a number of levels of sensitivity, usually, on a system. CIPSO, it's the Common Internet Protocol Security Option. It was initially the Commercial Internet Protocol Security Option. Name got changed somewhere in the pipe. This is a mechanism for adding security level information, security label information, into the header on IP packets. I will say CIPSO several times during the talk as well. Now you know what it is. There's a whole bunch of other jargon. I'm going to throw it out. I didn't have room on the slide for all of it, and some of it is just so ingrained in me, I don't even think of it as jargon anymore. So, yeah, at the end, we'll have questions. You can say, what on earth is a gonculator? And then I'll tell you. Why did we do mandatory access control in the first place? Ronald Reagan. In 1986, Ronald Reagan signed an executive order that said that by 1992, all United States government computer systems had to be evaluated against the American security criteria. It's called the Orange Book. Who can tell me why? Whoa. Because they're not very creative. Okay. The Department of Defense Trusted Computer Security Evaluation Criteria, TCSEC, or the Orange Book to those who know it and came to love it. It's a really handy reference, actually. If you want to know about computer security and you don't have anything else to go to, it's nice, big, easy-to-read font. Flying across the United States, you can read the whole thing and really know just about everything you need to know about computer security. It's a good read. All right, so Ronald signed this executive order and said all the systems have to meet these requirements. One of the requirements was for a mandatory access control system. And it turns out that the requirement for the mandatory access control system was just about that much harder to do than what Unix already did. So every computer vendor at the time said, well, you know, we're going to get the most bang for the buck. We're not going to do this. The system that doesn't have mandatory access control, if it's just that much, you know, just that little bit harder to do mandatory access control as well. So everybody did mandatory access control. And everybody implemented the Bell and LaPadula model because it's required by the Orange Book. so that you can meet the requirements and sell to the U.S. government. Now, 1992 came and went, and this executive order was never enforced. Much to the chagrin, of course, of all of us who had just sweated cannonballs to get this thing out and implemented in time. And then, of course, all the executive management turned to us and said, well, why did we spend all this money implementing these systems when nobody's buying them? So there was a great fall, and we've been building it back up ever since. Mac implementations. There are three fundamental kinds of Mac implementations that have been done since the Orange Book came out. First one, Bell and LaPadula sensitivity, which is outlined in the Orange Book. This was done in Multics and Unix. And in fact, Unix systems, every major vendor of a Unix system had at least one mandatory access control implementation of the Bell and LaPadula model. In fact, several had more than one. And if you take into account mergers since then, HP had at least four. All right, so that's the old-fashioned traditional way to do it. More recently, type enforcement has become popular. Type enforcement is actually implemented in the SE Linux model. Type enforcement takes a different approach. Rather than saying we're going to emulate the secret, top secret mechanisms used in the paper world, we're going to put things into domains and control the access across domains. Other systems are using pathname controls, saying if you're looking at etc shadow, it doesn't matter where etc shadow is on the disk, what its inode number is, what attributes are actually attached to that. Since the applications care about whatever it is that's called etc shadow, I'm going to protect etc shadow. Anything called etc shadow, whether it's symlink or whether it's coming through hard links, whatever, if it's called etc shadow, I'm going to protect it. That's another approach. Why would you use a mandatory access control system? Well, it turns out that the primary use of mandatory access control systems has always been and is still a security checkbox. Okay. Somebody called up and said, we need to have more security on this system than you can get off the shelf. What are we going to do? Somebody will come in and say, well, we've got this mandatory access control system. It's better. Check the box. System goes in. The other reason you'd use it, and this is the actually valuable reason, is when you're sharing an expensive machine. You've got two sets of user communities sharing an expensive machine. There's a machine in Scandinavia, a $20 million machine sold several years ago. They've got a weather service, university undergraduates, and an aircraft manufacturer sharing the machine. Now, you don't want the students looking at the airplane designs. Not that they wouldn't have useful criticisms, but sometimes you just don't want that information out too soon. You don't want your competitors getting that. The weather service information, you don't want anybody mucking with it because people count on that when they're going to have a picnic. And in Scandinavia, it really matters. If there's a nice day forecast, you want to take advantage of it. So when you're in a sharing environment like that, you can use a multi-level mandatory access control system to prevent access to things based on organizations. That, in fact, is the first one here, which is a disjoint set of users. Again, the aircraft manufacturers and the students. Again, sharing the machine, using the same resource. They're using the same CPU resources, but they can't look at each other's files at all. The other one is a hierarchical use of shared data. And I'll go back to a weather service, and this is the U.S. Navy does this. The notion is you've got all the unclassified weather data, which is available to the public. There's also the data that is used, actually, the computations that are done by the U.S. Navy, for example, over certain cities on the Persian Gulf. They're using the same data that everybody else is to do their weather predictions, but it really matters to them that not everybody knows that they're making those predictions. So you have a hierarchical sharing of data. You have low sensitivity data, but the fact that you're doing things to it is very sensitive. The fact that you're looking at it can be very sensitive, and so you don't want to share that with people. So that would be a hierarchical use of shared data. And that's Bell and LaPadula levels. And the first one's Bell and LaPadula categories. So where did SMAC come from? Well, traditional mandatory access control systems, and by this I'm going to talk about, use two systems in particular, Trusted Solaris, Trusted IRIX, because I did both of those. You have a data structure that defines the security characteristics. It'll have a level in it and a set of categories. In the Bell and LaPadula model, you can read something if your level is higher than the level on the object, and all the categories listed in the object are in your set. Okay, so essentially, if your label is bigger than the label on the file, you can read it. To write it, your label has to match, because otherwise data might flow down, and you're not allowed to do that. Now, the label relationships are hard-coded, so it's always the case that if your label is bigger, you can read it. If your label is the same, you can write it. Okay, that's the only relationship that's allowed. But, of course, nobody wants to type in level 4 categories 17, 49, and 113, so we map these to names. And so we would have a label called Mythtory, which could be Top Secret, Skeeve, Oz, Chumley, to match to those that level and categories. And the users only use the names, and in fact, the users are going to use Mythtory every time. They're never going to type out Top Secret, Skeeve, Oz, Chumley.
Do they even know that's what that means?
Usually they do. Okay. So the question was, do they even know what that name means? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Usually users will be told, use this alias when you log in for the label. And they just do that. So that's kind of the thing that came to my mind on this thing is, well, why bother to use anything but the names? So you just define the names and say, here's the label name, we're going to use that. So the SMAC labeling scheme, or mechanism, the label on a file that identifies its security characteristics is the same as its name. The process gets the same, it's the same thing. So it's just a text string. There's no implicit relationship between labels. That means that if I'm running it blue and you're running it red, I can't look at your data, you can't look at my data. Just implicitly, there's no relationship. There is a list of explicit relationships. And there are some system-defined labels that have relationships that are in general. And I can specify additional relationships. Okay, so every subject gets a label, every object gets a label, it's just a text string. Okay, and when a subject creates an object, so my process creates a file, it gets the label of the process that created it. Okay, so subjects access objects. LSTAT. LSTAT reads a file's attributes, so that's a read access. KILL writes to a process object. So in the case where we're... Okay, so here... Okay. So the question is, isn't a process a subject? Well, yes it is, but it is also a data container. Okay. So a process has two manifestations. When it's active, doing something, it's a subject. But when it is a data container that things are being done to, it's an object. So if I send a signal, if this process sends a signal to this process, what you're having is this process is being the subject that is writing a piece of information to this process. So that's the object. So subject does thing to object. So sending a signal is a write operation to the other process. Send, in particular, I'll use the UDP case because that's much simpler to comprehend than all the interactions you get with TCP. Send is also writing to a process object. So if I send a packet from me to you, what I'm doing is I'm doing a write to the process object over there. It's not doing anything. It's passive. It's being an object. It's getting written to. Now he wakes up and says, "Oh, look at this! I got something on my queue. I did a receive, and now I've got data out there. It just happened by magic. Okay, now I can be a subject and do something with the information that I've got." Okay. And with this model, bind is uninteresting from a security standpoint, because bind, there is no object involved. If I do a bind, what I have is I have a socket, which is an internal data structure to my process, and I'm changing some information in there. In fact, I've asked the system, "Hey, can I use this port number?" And it says, "Sure, go ahead." But I haven't modified any objects. I've just modified my own state. Okay, I've got somebody here who's going to object to that, and that's okay.
Yeah, well, I guess obviously you've instructed the operating system to set aside a data structure for you. So in effect, you have invoked an action upon an object, upon the operating system itself.
Yes. Yes.
So why isn't that interesting? Why isn't that important? Because
The reason it's not important. Okay. So the question is, I've allocated some information in my process, and I've modified that. Okay. Well, it's all internal, and nobody else has access to that. I mean, if I'm going to write to a register in my own process address space, or if I'm going to do some additions. That's not very interesting from a security context because nobody else can do it.
But if you bound to a particular port, that you're denying someone else accessing that port.
That we get into the namespace issue there.
Okay.
I'll talk about that more later. Okay, because that's a fun one. Okay. But there are no objects involved. Okay. I had somebody else over here.
What he said.
Okay. Okay. We can debate that more later. By the way, there are at least half a dozen different ways to do a networking model. Okay, and every one of them except for mine is wrong. All right, so system labels. I mentioned system labels here. I've got three system labels that are important. I've actually got four, but I'm not going to talk about the label. Okay, so we've got floor, hat, and star. Now, floor is spelled underscore, hat is spelled tilde, circumflex, and star is spelled asterisk. The star label only goes on objects. It doesn't go on subjects. A subject with the star label has no access to anything, by definition. An object with the floor label can be read by anybody, but can only be written by floor subjects. And a subject with a hat label can read anything, but again, can only write hat objects. All right, simple enough. The star, anybody can read or write the star, an object with the star label. However, you must be very careful assigning objects the star label. And this is why a subject with the star label can't access anything, because if it could go create files out there that everybody could read and write. That would be bad. Okay, why do you have this? Dev null. You don't want to have a copy of dev null at every label that anybody might be running with. You want to just have one dev null and let everybody have at it. Okay. So that's what the star object is. The star label is for. There are a couple of other instances as well. Dev zero. Certain implementations of PiDEs require it as well.
So would your average, say, hat user, for example, be able to create a star object?
No. Nope.
So only hat objects.
Okay. Objects get the label of the subject that creates them. So a hat process is going to create hat objects. Okay. It can't create a star object. Similarly, a floor process is going to create floor labels. Floor objects.
So who's creating the start?
Who is creating the star object, I hear? A privileged process at the beginning, at system installation. All right, so user labels. Now, without users, things are kind of pointless. So I have my diagram here. Hopefully my arrows are pointing in the right directions. The red arrows are read arrows. The black arrows are write arrows. All right, so user labels. And I've just defined here two of them arbitrarily here. I have SE Asia and DAP. It's short for Dapper.
Actually, shouldn't the top two be black?
No, those are read. Red is for read. Okay. Black is for write. I could have used white for write, but that I actually considered doing that, but I thought, no, I think people would be very confused if I put white arrows up there. So what have we got here? So a subject running it at SE Asia can read floor objects. A hat object can read SE Southeast Asia information. They can both read and write to the star objects, which of course are dev null. And everybody knows that when you read from dev null, you get nothing back successfully. And so we've got the two labels here. They can both read stuff up from the floor. There's the system information. The system backup utility, which is running at hat, can back up their information, you know, including the labels of the files, which is very important if you're doing a backup on this. They can't communicate with each other, though, because they're different labels. Unless you put an explicit rule in place. And this is how we implement schemes that are more sophisticated than just, no, you can't. Separation is easy. Okay. Careful sharing is what makes mandatory access control systems hard. So we're allowed to put in explicit access control rules. In this case, I've decided that SE Asia subject can read. That a DAP subject can read SE Asia objects. And so by putting a rule in place, I can allow data to flow in that direction. Now, that doesn't mean that SE Asia can write to DAP. It only means that DAP can read from SE Asia. Next line here, we've got med and pop. I've decided here that med can write anything she wants to pop. But this doesn't mean that pop can read from med. Okay, the access that's allowed here is a write access. So med wants to write to pop, that's fine. Pop wants to read from med, that's not going to be allowed. Okay. Yes, sir?
What's a difference between med writing and operating?
Okay, so the question is, what's the difference between med...
What's the benefit?
What's the benefit to making the distinction?
Yep.
I've got slides that will demonstrate that coming right up. Because that's the obvious question, of course. Well, what does it matter? The mechanism for specifying the rules is very straightforward. Have a file here, etc smack accesses, where you have a list of rules, a program called smackload, which actually reads that file and writes it down into the kernel. Sbin smackload writes into smackload. Smackload is an entry in SmackFS, which just loads these rules in. It's a very picky, peculiar kind of interface, so we don't have to do significant parsing in the kernel. And parsing in the kernel is considered a bad thing. Okay. Yes, I know where I am. All right. So how would we specify Bell and LaPadula levels? Bell and LaPadula levels, secret, top secret, unclassified, just like in the spy movies. All right, so secret is more sensitive than unclassified. Top secret is more sensitive than secret. So I would require three rules in order to set this up. First one says that secret can read, has read and write, read and execute access to unclassified. I also have to say that top secret has read and execute access to secret. Now I also have to say that top secret has read and execute access to unclassified because there is no implication, you know, implications don't exist here. You want it, you have to specify it explicitly.
So you just bring up an execute permission. So how is it defined?
Execute permission?
Yeah.
Execute permission, same as with DAC bits.
Okay, so
as you will. Okay, and all relationships must be specified. All right, so Bell and LaPadula categories. The way Bell and LaPadula categories work is if you have, again, if your set of categories is a superset of the object's set of categories, you can read it. And if it's the same, you can write it. So I've defined two categories here. I call them Skeeve and Oz. So in Bell and LaPadula, if you have both Skeeve and Oz, you can read Skeeve and you can read Oz. And you can read Skeeve Oz. But since Skeeve Oz is the same as you already are, you get that for free. Two rules here. You specify one says that Skeeve Oz can read Skeeve and that Skeeve Oz can read Oz. So Bybe integrity. Anybody know what Bybe integrity is? Yeah. Okay, Bybe integrity, mathematician named, whose first name escapes me, but his last name was Bybe, of all things, looked at the Bell and LaPadula sensitivity model and said, hey, if you turn this upside down, it's an integrity model. So if you say that floor defines a high integrity, defines high integrity objects and processes, hat defines low integrity, that means a high integrity process can't read low integrity information, whereas a low integrity process can read high integrity information. That makes sense. So you just define it in the opposite order. We're going to get into answering your question now. All right. Okay. So the ring of vigilance. So one of my favorite security schemes that you cannot implement using a Bell and LaPadula model. Okay, he's looking at me funny. This is good. All right.
Do you want to do this?
Yes. Yes, I know places that want to do this.
Yeah, why?
Why? Ah, I'll tell you that. I will tell you this. Because people don't trust each other. Imagine somebody at a security talk saying that, right? Inconceivable. No, people don't trust each other, but people are often willing to delegate trust. Thank you. Often willing to delegate trust in a circular fashion. So I'll watch you. You watch her. She'll watch me. And if we do it that way, then we can't gang up on, you know, nobody can gang up on each other. Everybody, yeah. Things will go smoothly. You're furrowing your brow. You've been working with SE Linux too long. All right. Yes, sir?
Presumably, it would just two be fine as well, both reading from each other?
Yes, and in fact, there are very important situations where that's actually appropriate. For example, there are cell phones where you can buy content. In fact, you can buy applications, and sometimes these applications will want to share information. Not all the information. They certainly won't want to grant each other write access. So imagine your cell phone. You've got ES. How many of you are familiar with the American TV networks? Okay. We've got ESPN, which is a sport network. We've got ABC, which is a general purpose network. They're owned by the same parent company. Right. So you buy the application from ESPN to look at your sports news. You buy the application from ABC to look at your general news. The ESPN application wants to look at the ABC information to see if any sports stories have shown up on your list, because they want to make sure that that the ESPN application has the full story. Whereas the ABC is going to be looking over at the ESPN to see if there's enough information there about a story that on the sports side that's really important that they don't want to bother saying anything about it. Okay. You want to look at the information, but you don't want to be able to write it. Now, one very important aspect of this is that when the parent company sells ESPN to Fox, you want to break that connection. So you want to change your access rule so that they're no longer allowed to share. Okay? So this example here, everybody can, you know, you can read in the circle, and you're not protecting the information here, but you're controlling the flow. Okay. And since it's a read operation, okay, the person who's pulling the information decides what information gets pulled. Now, if those were black arrows and those were write permissions, it would be the same kind, it would be a different kind of thing for messaging. It's like, I can send you the information I want you to have. Why would you do this? You're a corporation, you have an auditor, and you have the revenue service, the tax people. Okay. I decide what I send to the to my auditors. My auditors decide what goes to the tax people. The tax people decide what they tell me. Okay. So that's a control that's it's different from read. It's a different intention. It's who's in control of the information flow. Does that answer your question? All right. Okay, I've just been told, by the way, that things are running out. So here's the right situation again. Okay, so time of day access. This is one of my favorites. All right. So we've got a worker bee label. Most of our people in the company are worker bees. And we have game programs out on the server. So a perk that they're allowed to use from 5 p.m. until 8 a.m., after which we turn them off. And at 8 a.m., we also go out and we kill them all. But, yeah. Of the worker. I love the English language. All right. So, and so at 5 o'clock, you say, okay, worker bees can use these things now. They have execute access. And at 8 a.m., you say, they don't. All right, so implementation. I've been given the 5-minute signal here already, so I'm going to try to be as quick as I can here. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to cover here, real quickly. All right, labeling scheme. Okay, labels are short text strings. I already said that. They're compared for equality. In fact, this is the only operation that is ever performed on them, is they are compared with each other. So they're compared for equality. And they're stored in a list. And this list never goes away. Since you have a finite number of labels that you're going to be using at any given time, it's not going to be a big list. And quite frankly, if it ever does get to be a big list, this is an opportunity for some undergrad who can't get dates to actually do some optimization work. And I'd be perfectly happy to have somebody do some optimization work on this. Right now, it's just a list. Things that are stored in that list, along with the label, are a sec ID. This is because certain other subsystems require a sec ID. That's an LSM interface which is not official, but which is actually there. I have an optional SIPSO value. If you're going to talk between processes using networking, using SIPSO, and you want to use an explicit value rather than one we're going to make up, that's where you specify it. And again, it's never forgotten. All right, access checks. Rules get written to smack load. We've got the hard-coded labels, floor, hat, star. Check and see if the subject and object labels are equal. If they are, you got access. If they're not, then we find that subject-object pair in the list. If we do have that subject-object pair, that's the access that's granted. If you don't, if you do find it, then you check the access you're requesting against the access that's in the rule. If you never find one, then you have no access. Okay, file systems use extended attributes if they're available. If they don't use extended, some file systems don't support extended attributes, we have hard-coded behavior for them. SmackFS, PipeFS, SockFS, ProcFS, etc.
BFS.
Who?
BFS.
Who?
BFS, an
ISO 9660. For that, we're going to use what's on the super block, and that's going to get defined at mount. Okay, so there's a file system root label value, a file system default value, and a minimum and maximum, which is not implemented yet. Networking model. I touched on this briefly. You can start flapping your arms when I get really, really over.
That's all right. You've got about 8 minutes before you stop, so that includes question time.
Okay, great. So I've already gotten questions, so I figure I'm just going to barrel through here. All right, so networking model. Again, the networking model is that the sender writes to the receiver. The sender is the subject. The receiver is the object. That's just the way it works. The socket, the packet, are not policy components. It doesn't matter what label is on the socket, on the packet, because the label came off of the subject. And it will match it, and that's the way the system works. First example here, William Janet W means that William has write access to Janet objects. That allows a UDP packet. And again, the symmetry with read doesn't apply. So the fact that Janet can read William packets doesn't allow a UDP packet through, because the policy is that it's the sender writing to the receiver. It's not the receiver reading from the sender. Okay. Packet labeling. There's a label value defined, which is the ambient label. So unlabeled packets are given the ambient label. On transmission, every packet is given a SIPSO option. And that's going to be one of two values. It's either going to be an explicit value, which is in the list, or it's going to be what I call a SIPSO direct mapping. We're going to take the label string, we're going to set the level in the SIPSO option to be 250, and then we're going to copy the bits out of the string into the categories in the SIPSO option, and ship that across as the SIPSO option. This is cheating, and it's ugly, and it's completely in opposition to what SIPSO is supposed to be like, but it works just fine. And quite frankly, so long as your SIPSO mappings are the same on the machines on both sides, it'll work just fine. And if it smacks systems on both sides, it'll always work. It's the same SIPSO implementation as SE Linux uses. Exactly the same SIPSO implementation. All right, so the LSM. I said that I would comment on the LSM talk description, and so I will. The LSM provides a restrictive interface. A restrictive interface means that it allows you to put additional restrictions on access controls. It does not allow you to replace existing access controls. That's got its pluses and its minuses. Its pluses are it makes it a lot more difficult to hijack the Linux behavior model with a proprietary module. On the other hand, there are some things that you would like to be able to do. POSIX access control lists, for example, cannot be implemented using a restrictive model because they interact heavily with the mode bits. The LSM has evolved in step with SE Linux. SE Linux was for a very long time the only user of the LSM that was actually making real progress in getting into the tree. So of course, they have evolved in step and in cooperation with each other. The LSM is imperfectly defined. In particular, the networking code doesn't use LSM interfaces, although it uses data that logically should be. The audit system doesn't use LSM interfaces, although that's one of the tasks on my plate now, is to make it so that it does, because it uses SE Linux interfaces directly, all of which have analogous LSM interfaces. There's a little teeny bit of information in the USB stack where it pulls the SecID out of the thin air if you're using SE Linux, out of someplace appropriate if you're using SE Linux, and out of thin air otherwise, and sends that back in a kill to send a signal. So again, these are three places where the interface for the LSM is kind of arbitrarily done on the side differently than the way the LSM was intended. Module stacking is a mechanism, isn't the notion that you can have multiple security modules in your kernel simultaneously. This has been an area of considerable debate, with many people being pro and many people being con, but since there's no one actually doing it yet, it's not there. Someday we'll probably have it. I used to be adamantly on the side of no, you shouldn't do stacking. I have since seen the light, hallelujah, and I now believe that there are valuable ways that you can stack modules in interesting ways.
We need some trivial modules for easily stack modules to get this done.
That's one argument.
But if you had some trivial module that could work with either Mac or Easy Linux that could easily stack, then that would provide an incentive for it. Like, for example,
we certainly have a case here where we got one part, one contingent is saying, well, show me some modules and then we'll allow them to stack. And the other contingent says, well, but if I can't stack it, it's pointless. So, yeah.
Same thing with Linux. You've got to get the code first. And obviously, I mean, you can't stack both SE Linux and SMAC. I mean, they're not going to work together well.
This, sir, is an assumption on your part. And I'm not... there are actually enough other things that I have to do first before I. But there are certain aspects of SMAC. For example, the fact that you can change the rules dynamically without relabeling your file system and rebooting. That would be very attractive. That could be very attractive in even SE Linux environments.
Most policy changes don't require that.
Nonetheless. Most people don't require multi-level security either. Okay, 1 minute. I got 1 minute. Oh, okay. I got a bunch of programming interfaces. Wherever possible, I just used what was already there. As a result, if you want to deal with the attributes, get xadder, set xadder, or out of proc adder current. Socket interfaces, these are the same ones you use for SE Linux. If you read their documentation, you'll be pretty good there, all except that... these first two, let's see, if you're administering the system, these are the SMACFS, these are the places you write information to change the system defaults. SMACLOAD is where the rules go. And what have you learned? I'm going to wrap up. This is my wrap-up slide. Okay, great. All right. Okay, so SMAC is a modern implementation of old-school mandatory access control, and I hope to have omitted the mistakes. SMAC's designed for simplicity. Wherever possible, I made it simpler. And it's designed to be a kernel mechanism. I don't really like having very much user space dependencies on kernel behavior. So the kernel should just be able to go off and do the things kernels do best. Special thank yous. Okay. Paul Moore for the networking interfaces, Ahmad Darwish, who actually wrote some of the SMACFS code. Very important reviewers who put a lot of work into preventing me from looking really, really stupid here. And if you need to contact me, schaufflerca.com is the homepage for SMAC. kcschaufflerca.com is my email. And apparently there's one of the network providers here in Australia doesn't like hyphens in domain names. I don't pretend to understand. It's okay. By the way, it's the one this conference uses. rancidfat@yahoo.com. Yeah, we'll get you there as well. And I'm out of time, if I recall. Yeah. Thank you very much.
A mouse?
A mouse
and a penguin.
Yes, and a penguin.
The penguin.